Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. Today we've got with us Deb Nicholson, who's the executive director of the PSF. Deb, thank you for coming on and joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. I thought that we had you on already, but that I think that's just because I've met you. I met you at DjangoCon US this year, and you were very helpful talking to me and Anna on the Django Software Foundation board, or maybe it was Haim, one of us. You've been very helpful with the Django community, and so it's great to have you on and talk about your work and how Python and Django interact. Because on our end, sometimes people think that we are just Django is just a subset of the PSF. I don't know if you probably don't get that, but I imagine people assume that the PSF is like this godlike thing that controls everything and has an infinite budget, when in fact, maybe you could say, like, what's the setup of the Python Software Foundation for those who aren't aware?
I have yet to find the godlike budget. If there is one, it is being hidden from me. But I'll keep looking. We do get a lot of people who probably think we're in charge of other things. I hit this sometimes with NumFocus. Like, I'll get notes and I'll be like, "Hey, can you hook me up with a PyData ticket?" And I'm like, "No, not because I don't want to, but because it's not our conference." But luckily I know whose conference it is, so I can be like, "Oh, you should speak with Leah. She's great. And can talk to you about PyData." Not so much on Django, maybe because the name is a little different. I guess, like all the NumFocus projects have, like almost all of them have Py in the name. So that probably makes it a little more confusing. But I think for Django, like people, it has a different enough name. Maybe from further out, but I've mostly been talking to people inside the community, so I haven't hit too much of that confusion. There might be a couple people out there that think like you're a fiscal sponsory of ours. I don't know.
That would good. Is that available?
Yeah, we'll get into the fiscal sponsorship stuff later.
Okay, so Deb, there's lots of talk in the Django community about how we need an executive director. We need someone to do your job, because basically we're all like this, juggling so many balls in the air, and we can't do it, and lots doesn't happen. But what on earth is an executive director?
It entirely depends on the size of the organization. So like many years ago, before I came to like open source nonprofits, I was working in a small place with like three people, and we hired someone who thought like she was gonna sit around like Mad Men and dictate letters, and people would bring her fizzy water and stuff. And I was like, there's only three people here and you're one of them. I don't know who you think is gonna take a letter. So for a small organization, and before this, I was at the Open Source Initiative as like the general manager, which is sort of like the executive director, but without the title. And now they have an executive director, but the smaller the org is, right, the more hats you wear, basically. PSF now has, we have an events team, we have folks that work with the community, like all different parts of the community, and we have infrastructure, and particularly with a focus on security, which is sort of a thing that we have all decided that we're going to finally pay attention to in open source. Great. So there's about 12 of us. So it's a little, no one brings me fizzy water,
nearly.
But, you know, there are a few things that, I can delegate to other people. So my job, like with that size of an organization, means I am paying attention to a lot of the staffing, making sure that, kind of the like places where the different work meets, isn't shifting and stuff in a way that's like confusing, or not fair or too much for somebody to do in a regular healthy work week. So there's that. And then also I kind of like take on, everyone has their like stack of things that they do. And then if something comes in from left field, like then I take a look at it. If it's high profile, I'll take it. If it's like something that we should be doing, I kind of figure out where it would go in the organization or how to respond. So I get like all of the weird out of band stuff.
That makes sense.
which somebody needs to, because otherwise people, everyone is getting out of band stuff. And then you have a whole organization of panickers that are just like, oh my gosh, should we watch Twitter like with our teeth gritted like all day, like the whole staff? And it's like, no, like maybe one person, but not all 12 of us, because that's not very good use of time. Oh, yeah. And on X, right? So
so in Django, we have the two Django fellows. So it's 1.5 full-time roles, basically.
Yeah.
And but their role is very much like to look after the code side and to do the ticket triage and the ticket pull request review and do the releases and security things. But quite often there'll be these kind of other jobs which, oh, well, let's ask the fellows. And they pick it up. But it's not the role. And so that's kind of, and they don't have capacity to take on very much more. So,
right.
That's, and on the admin side, historically, it's been the president and the treasurer who've taken these up. And actually, I mean, you know, when you spoke with us, Deb, you know, it was just this like, oh my God, that's exactly what we need, because all the things you listed are all the things that I think any tech nonprofit of a certain size, which the DSF is and PSF is, needs. And I mean, a big one that the DSF, the current board, has been working on is having working groups, because historically on the DSF board, the members did the work. And if they didn't do it, it didn't get done. Whereas I know the PSF has been a little bit better about basically agreeing on what should be done and then delegating, and maybe one person's involved, but it's more of a, I believe, overarching role rather than like, oh, and you're actually going to do it all in your, you know, volunteer time.
Yeah. Well, and we've been looking at some of the working groups too, and kind of realizing that most of them need like a staff person to kind of like help them stay even keeled. Because, I mean, volunteer involvement kind of has a little up and a down to it. And so having that staff person that sort of like makes sure it's like, oh, I set up this month's meeting, even if it's only like 2/3 of the committee, like we're going to meet and report out on progress. And if somebody's stuck or something, or like, you know, people didn't want to like spend their own personal money to set up some account or whatever, and it should be the org, you know, like all these weird little things that it's like volunteers are either don't want to do or don't know if they're allowed to do. If you have a staff person that is meeting with them occasionally, it's like, oh, no, we're allowed to, you know, pay $10 a month for that thing that would make the work better and stuff like that. So it's, but it also helps keep it, make sure like the meeting happens. And so we're sort of looking at how to add that to like a lot of the working groups and get that support in there.
The other thing you said there was not one person not taking on too much, because that often happens, is that, you know, they're the hero and then they take on another thing and then another thing and then another thing, and then eventually they just blow up.
Yeah, exactly. And so the other thing I think about with nonprofits is like, I don't know if it's like Tai Chi where you go where the energy is, right?
So, you know,
like,
Carlton does Tai Chi, by the way. So you're,
oh, okay.
That's why
so
he's beaming.
This is, you can tell
I've got
me
a
this
class
a
just after this.
Analogy. But so like if you take a volunteer who's like, oh, I love the community, I love writing code, and then you're like, cool, can you learn how to do a 990 filing with the IRS?
Yeah, right.
That's,
like, really
that's what I did for the DSF. That's actually I still got pinged. I can say this. I still got pinged for like finding an old one for this current year's one. So it's when Catherine,
It's hard because that one is like you're using more of your like your store of volunteer enthusiasm by getting someone to do something they definitely don't want to do and have never done before and are not interested in learning how to do.
Yeah.
Than when you just ask people to do things they like doing and are good at and enjoy, or maybe you're on their personal growth roadmap. Like, oh, I always wanted to learn how to like talk to people more or do more writing, and it's like, oh, awesome, that's great. Almost nobody has, like, I've always been curious about filing 990s on their personal roadmap, unless you're an accountant.
Will, that's your kind of back, don't
you? Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm an odd duck. I'm an odd duck because I have an MBA, and our the board's assistant, Catherine Holmes, actually has an accounting degree. But yes, most people are like, yeah, I want to, like, community and code. And it's like, oh, no, be a manager. And by the way, don't mess these things up. Like, I don't know how many skeletons in the closet I want to talk about publicly, but you know, it doesn't always happen the way it should. And then you have to, there's a whole process for if you miss, you know, not under my watch, but if you miss filing a 990, there's a whole, you know, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. Many years ago, I was on the board of an arts nonprofit locally here in Massachusetts. And at some point, like, we had the person who was doing the accounting for us, like, we just were not grateful enough. And so she was finally, one year, it was like, there's a bag in my closet. You can come by when I'm not home to pick it up. And I was like,
oh, wow.
That was the accounting.
Okay. Oh, I can't wait to see what's in the bag. Or really, what's
that's like the movie the Seven. Yeah, what's in the bag?
What's not in the bag? And so, yeah, so like, and that was like someone who was like, I want to make art. And we're like, you get to do the accounting.
Yeah.
Right. I mean,
like, that had started before I got there, but I was like, really? Oh, that's so weird. Is it sort of like a performance art accounting? Like, no, it's real, just regular accounting.
Yeah. Well, in that, especially as an organization, you know, as the Django Software Foundation, it's sort of stayed the same, but the PSF has definitely grown. You know, you go from manageable to not manageable with these things. I mean, like, I'll give you one example, and I'm sure there's a PSF equivalent where the DSF has had a sitting cash budget, or, you know, reserves of around, I think it was around $200,000. And Pete Bumgartner, who was the new, took over as treasurer for me, though he's now off the board, was like, hey, this is just sitting here. Interest rates are high. Why don't we put it in a high yield account and get 5%? Mm-hmm. So he did. So that's $10,000 a year that the DSF is getting that they weren't before. But it's,
nice.
You know, he just happens to know that because he runs a consulting business. And that, you know, that's kind of why I was like, Pete, I really want you to have this role. So there's so many things like that, right, that are separate from community and code, but are vital to running the thing, keeping it sustainable. And it's kind of a miracle the DSF is still as functioning as it is, given all these concerns.
Yeah. The other one I think people are surprised about is that, like, when you talk to sponsors, it's a little bit of a customer service relationship.
Yeah.
And people are like, what? And I'm, and you know, I don't, like, I have done customer service. And so I'm like, yeah, no, people expect to be thanked a couple more times than maybe you think is strictly necessary. because they're not involved in your work and they're just writing a big check. Like, that's, you know. And so, so that one I've seen, like, smaller projects without staff kind of choke on, and they're like, why all the paperwork? Like, they're writing you like a $100,000 check. Like, there's going to be some paperwork. Get over it.
Yeah. Like, well, and that's the thing is that, I mean, the DSF has, I think, suffered from the fact that we're just so small, because a larger, like, let's pick a large company. A, they don't want to bother writing a check unless it's a certain amount. Mm-hmm. And B, you know, yeah, they have, there's a whole well-established process for asking for grants, maintaining those grants, thanking them for the grants. And, you know, when it's just board members, you know, who are software developers, we definitely drop the ball on that. So that's a scaling issue for sure.
Yeah. Well, and it's, again, it's probably something that you want to have staff doing. Again, like, most people don't have, like, oh, I would like to have a lot of high stakes meetings about money with strangers on their personal growth roadmap, unless fundraising is a skill they want to develop.
Right. So, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is a separate skill. That's the thing. It's not.
I went to public school in the U.S. That's the cheap one that you get to go to for free. And so that means we just, like, fundraise all the time. So I grew up, like, I'm sure the neighbors were like, oh, God, it's that Nicholson girl again. Because I'd be like, oh, today we're selling wrapping paper for the elementary school. Hi, today it's cookies for Girl Scouts. Like, tomorrow I'll be back for, like, with, you know, candy bars for the band. Like, everything. We just, like, we're constantly, like, Your gift means so much. Like, I'll see you get this chalky candy bar.
Yeah, my wife and I are in the PTO here. Actually, I'm the webmaster. Yay. I'm going to resist going down a political angle on that one. But yes, it is it's a whole thing in many places. But maybe, Carlton, we're just going to jump all around. Carlton mentioned the fellows. The PSF has some new fellows, right? I believe.
We call them developers in residence, but it's, like, probably about the same thing. So Wukash, like, I guess like before I got here, it was like, oh, we should eventually have three people doing that. And then the pandemic came and it was like, whew, wow, what's going on with our finances? And it's like, well, we're not hiring two more people. That's what's going on for the first year or two. And then we're kind of finally back around again where it's like, oh, I think we could do this. So he wrote a blog post a little while ago and was like, I could really use a second person. And so we had someone respond almost immediately at Bloomberg was like, we would like to hire that second CPython developer person. And that's Peter. And then we also, it was like someone, we got an anonymous donation like, hey, how much would it cost to just complete the set that we talked about a while ago? And so then we were able to also offer a position to Sergey. Both of them have a long history with the CPython community. Like, lots of people are familiar with their work. So it wasn't like, surprise, where'd these folks come from? But it was just like, oh, finally, they can just like full on work for us and instead of, you know, do a lot of unpaid work for us that's a little less directed. So it hasn't changed so much. They both are sort of coordinating with Wukash. And so the work is more directed, but also they're both able to work for us full time, which is fantastic.
So Python's a much bigger thing than Django, but I've always felt that the Django Fellowship program was for Django, like the reason why it was able to keep going over the long run. So Django's 18 this, you know, last year. It's going to be 19 this year, 20 next year. We'll buy it a beer in a couple of years' time. But there's no way it would have got there through that 10 to 15 year age group without the fellowship program coming on, because you know it was in trouble and then the fellowship program started and then all of a sudden actually Django is as strong now as it ever has been.
Nice.
And that's just because of the, I guess, the limits of volunteer effort. And is the feeling the same there in Python, actually the verb in residence is about the sustainability, secures the sustainability of Python?
It's about doing those things that aren't really anyone's passion project, but like really need to get done. Like yesterday, Wukash was working on build bots, which he's like, there's no way volunteers would want to do this. I'm going to be on this all day. I'm like, okay, great. But I'm so glad you're doing it because there are a lot of things like that in CPython. So it's just like, there's also, you know, we have the PEP process and a lot of times the PEP comes in and it's like, whoa, we still have a lot of questions about this one. It seems like maybe the writer has the answers, but didn't share them or didn't know that we would want them or how to share them or whatever. And so like Wukash does a lot of work with people, who are proposing PEPs and like, hey, so like, just so you know, like when the steering council looks at this, they're going to want to know how it interacts with this and this and this. So if you include that, your PEP is going to have a much better chance of being taken seriously and considered on its merits, as opposed to like, whoa, I don't know what that would do.
Yeah, I can imagine that helps a lot. Well, I always joke that it's hard to get a feature into Django, but I watch the odd PEPs go through and I think, wow, it's really hard to get something into Python.
As you said, it's big. And so everything we change touches like a zillion other
things. Yeah, so many people. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And then it's like even just dealing with the like, you know, people have thoughts about the things that are being changed. You know, we have a whole forum for discussing them. And which is good. Like I actually wish people would tell us, you know, politely, but like, you know, more about like how they're feeling about different PEPs, because then we could foresee more of the places that it touches. So that one's always a little frustrating when it's like, oh, okay. Like on the forum or something, it feels like we talked about this for like a year and then someone's like, hey, it broke my thing. And it's like, oh, we've been talking about like how we're going to make this change like forever. And like, there was like a lengthy, I guess you didn't get your invite or I don't know why you're invited. And in case anyone's listening to this and been like, how do you get that invite? You're already invited. Like,
yeah, just turn
please
up,
come
yeah.
and tell us about how changes coming down the pike will affect your code.
But the people who are listening to this podcast or on the forums or on the, you know, the Python ideas, they're such a small subset of the user base that it's always the case that, oh, we thought we'd done this right, but it turns out we broke that or this happened or that happened. And
yeah. Well, or the classic thing with open source, which is like, oh, we have been like re-implementing a bug that you fixed like 5 years ago internally because our stuff rests on it. And we just didn't want to mention that because it's like our trade secret or whatever. And then it's like, oh, we changed it so you can't even just re-implement the bug anymore. And then they're like kind of upset. And I'm like, How are we supposed to know that you've been secretly re-implementing a bug internally, like, for like 5 years? Like, that's
there's no win. There's
work
no
in
win.
The open. It's and then we can help you. But if you're doing it secret inside and not telling us, then like we can't really account for it.
Yeah, and then when those things do happen, it's kind of a thankless task in that there was nothing you could have done right in that case.
Yeah.
Well, I think I'm not going to beat the drum too much on Django's executive director needs because I've already talked about it. But
I'm sold. How do we get one?
I was going to say, I've talked a lot with Jeff Triplett, for example, who was on the PSF board. And I think the easiest, we've had discussions of these at the most recent DjangoCon, DjangoCon US, DjangoCon Europe, smaller groups. So I'll just share it around how would we do it if we were going to have an executive director? And I think the easiest way is to get the fellows program funded by Bloomberg, pick a place and say, you know, for 2-3 years, do you want to be, you know, sponsor the fellows? Because for the DSF, our budget is 2/3 or more fellows. So if we got a company that said, yeah, for 3 years, I'll sponsor the fellows program, which is less than it's just like the cost of a single developer for a West Coast firm. And then they can get whatever marketing they want. That would
maybe get someone in Ohio.
Yeah, right. Then they would get, then we could have an executive director for 3 years and, you know, see all these things that would happen. So I think that's, to the extent there's a magic bullet, I think, but, you know, then it requires someone within the DSF community who has the knowledge to go through that process with these big companies, right? And to the customer service angle.
Do you think it would necessarily have to be someone from within your community?
To be the executive director? Personally, no. I think in some ways it might be better if it's not, actually.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing I would do if I was to hire an executive director for an organization that hasn't had one before is make a list of things that the board is doing and doesn't want to do or is doing and is often feeling like they're too late. Mm-hmm. Like, no, I really need to be doing this every day and I can't. I only can do it once a week. Like, so list off those things and then list off what you think the organization needs to get to the next place where you don't have to worry about, so you get like a certain amount of funding. And then, so I'm guessing fundraising is going to be on that list. That person is going to have to be doing a lot of fundraising and be really good at creating new connections and bringing in money.
I mean, there's low hanging fruit everywhere. I mean, one thing we should say, I think maybe not everyone in Django knows that, you know, during COVID, we DSF was actually in a fairly strong position because, you know, the PSF was conference based largely, right? So no conferences kind of blows up the budget. Whereas the DSF, we do have conferences, but they are not big fundraisers. So we were in it was less of an issue for us. But I know I guess you came in midway through that, right? That was a little bit existential for the PSF when you say we have 7-figure costs and then our main fundraiser goes virtual. You know, was that right? What was the timing of when
it did work. I came in, right before, just a couple weeks before PyCon in 2022. So I showed up and no one had met me or knew who I was. And so it was amazing. Cause like I had all these great conversations. I actually remember this young woman who, I sat with at lunch and she was like, "Can you believe it? I've only been doing Python for 6 months and the people who run this conference paid for my travel to come here." And I was like, "Wow, that's great." Which I was like, I love that. I'm so glad that we're supporting you so early in your journey. But I don't think she knew she was talking to the executive director.
Well, isn't that great, though? Later. Like when people are just, they give it to you raw.
I know. So I got to, that was really interesting. But yeah, I joined during the pandemic and I came on like 3 weeks before the first conference back in person.
Okay. Yeah. Cause we did have, I guess in 2021, we had Eva on this podcast talking about her journey and, you know, coming up as a conference organizer to where she was. So yeah, that was always something that was like, you know, on the DSF board, we like, well, at least our funding isn't all wrapped up in this one thing that COVID blew up, because
yeah,
that was,
well, and we've been working on like sort of like pulling, you know, so that we're not quite so dependent on the PyCon funding. And like, you know, working on more programmatic sources for income, you know, like all of the like folks that fund people that, to work on CPython or to work on security at the PSF, amazing, like Meta and Bloomberg, AWS and OpenSSF, like all of those are program funding, not PyCon funding.
Carlton, I have a whole list of questions, so raise your hand.
No, go. I'll jump in when I've, you know, got.
Well, I wanted to say, so I was in the audience for your talk at DjangoCon this year, which we'll put a link mm-hmm. to, which I love that talk. I love, I guess, the softer talks. Could you briefly describe
just a
that?
Little.
Yeah, because I love those kind of talks. I should say, actually, yeah. I met Carlton and I connected because he gave a similarly non-code heavy talk about mm-hmm. growing old gracefully as a developer. And I wasn't there in person, but saw it online and reached out to him. And then that started this whole thing. So yes. So your talk, what was it about?
It was about meetups, and it was really just a love letter to meetups. So like my, so I used to be the co-organizer for the Boston Python meetup, like many, many years ago before I ever thought of coming to work here as the executive director. And I love the meetups. I think it's so interesting to be able to like kind of have each community customized locally to like what people are interested in learning, what people are interested in doing, like what kinds of activities they want to engage in together. And doing that, and then like what I want to do is kind of strengthen the connection between those sorts of edges or like, you know, all our little front doors all over the place to the community back up to the main, to the PSF. So we do already like fiscally sponsor a couple of the large meetups, including the Boston Python meetup. And we run a big mega meetup account, which like a lot of the Django meetups and Python meetups are on. So like we pay one fee and then we get unlimited meetups. Well, not unlimited, but we haven't hit the limit yet. And then we, you know, are always like kind of looking at what other ways could we help meetups do their work. And so that's a sort of on my list of things that I want to do is, you know, are there other resources or things that we could provide besides the meetup account or for meetups that want to be a fiscal sponsoree, you know, a PEX card, which is like a debit card so they don't have to buy pizza with their own money. So, yeah.
Well, there's, I was meaning to tell you the Django Boston meetup was an active one pre-COVID, and it's actually getting back together. And I believe I'm going to be speaking at one of the first ones. And actually they were like, who else should we invite? And I was like, well, do you know Deb? So I don't know if they've reached out yet, but if not, I'll coordinate that because that's another, and actually I don't know if they're aware of the meetup thing that maybe they could get under that umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
I'll reach out to them, but yeah, you're completely right. I mean, especially in a city, you know, Boston's not a huge city, but it's big enough. There's the Python one. There was the Django one. There's all these different ones. And there's, yeah, it's like, it's the cross-pollination too is really great. If you like, I for a while, I was going to a whole bunch of React ones. And
yeah,
just to like
the
see.
The Boston Python.
Sorry.
It's like one of the largest meetups. It's like 10,000 people are on that mailing list.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, and there's multiple ones, right? Because there's like the come together and like get help with your project. There's sometimes mm-hmm. people give a talk.
They're all run under the same umbrella by Ned Batchelder. But it's like before, like when I was there, we were doing talk nights, hack nights with like one beginner table, and then eventually two beginner tables because we had so many people coming in as beginners, and then puzzle night, which was like two or three people would go and do the same puzzle and then talk through their solution so that people could see like different ways to attack the same problem. And then like once or twice we had like some author let us know like, hey, I'm going to be in town, and we're like, all right, we'll just have like an author meet the author night.
Like a Python author?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So now I can't remember their names. So I'm sorry.
That's okay. There's a few of them.
Yeah. It was like over 10 years ago. So, but yeah, we were doing a lot of different things. And then it's that the meetup in Boston continues to evolve. The thing is that Boston, for a smaller city, I mean, smaller than New York and Los Angeles, I guess, but is a huge Python town because we have so much biotech, like people are working to cure cancer and build solar energy and all this different science stuff because we've got MIT. So everybody is in Cambridge. Like when I took the job at the PSF, everyone's like, oh, Python. I use Python. Everyone told me they use Python. Like everyone I met for like a whole year was like, oh yeah, that's great. I totally use Python for this. And they would tell me what they use Python for.
And all the students, because Python is, I think, the most popular.
It's a huge student town too. Cause like we have MIT, but we also have Harvard and, which has a computer science program. It seems funny because it's just down the street from MIT, but it does. Boston University, Boston College.
Yeah, Northeastern. Wentworth. There's a whole ton of them.
Yeah, there's a ton. And a lot of them are using Python. So for the size of town we are, it's an extremely big Python town.
Yeah. You know, thinking out loud, I should host a Django Girls night for the Django Boston thing because I can talk to Ned about that because there's probably some way to joint do it. Because especially during the school year, I think it depends on the event. You don't always get college graduate students, but there's so many people who are interested in this.
I think that'd be great. And someone just told me the other day that they thought the Boston Pie Ladies meetup was maybe getting revived again.
Oh, okay.
Which is good. Like, just a lot of meetups took a big hit during the pandemic. It was like, you know, part of it was really meeting in person.
But there's as well post-COVID, or not even post-COVID, it's not gone anywhere, it's still there. It's like the big conferences, it's like, yeah, you really want to go, but also there's can we do a smaller meetup locally? That might be safer or easier, and it might be more environmentally sort of sustainable.
Well, PyCon this year in Pittsburgh is going to be masked. We made a choice to continue to not pretend that COVID is finished, and especially bringing people from 100 different countries around the world. All coming in with the latest strains of whatever they got on the airplane. It's like, ooh, maybe, you know, I mean, like, I don't know if you went to a lot of conferences in the before times, but, you know, I would get like a cold or flu or something.
Yeah, every single one.
Like a couple times a year. Just like, oh, I guess that's just my job. I go and I kind of sample germs from like 50 different countries like every other month and then see what I brought home. So
it's like being a preschool teacher. Yeah. Well, they had, DjangoCon, DjangoCon was masked and personally, I think it's a good choice, but I know it's a difficult one for organizers.
Yeah. People are, it's interesting because so on the one hand we get these like, oh my gosh, I'm so glad this is the only conference I'm going to be able to attend this year. Like, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You know, and then we get the other end, which like sometimes goes from like a pretty sincere, like, I do find it really hard to socialize when I can't see all of people's faces. And I'm like, I get that. And we are like looking at like, can there be outside spaces or like, you know, that people can hang out in because we're a little later in the year this year. But then other people, it's just like, oh, you SJWs with your face diapers. And I'm like, okay. I know when I click over to the rest of your profile on X, I'm not going to be sad that you aren't attending our event.
Yeah. Just say thank you. Thank you next.
Yeah. So it's like... Yeah, and I get it. It's like we are looking for like ways that we could hold a safer event. So like this is our first year in Pittsburgh, so we'll be looking at some of the airflow stuff and seeing if like maybe we could just have the talk rooms or put like more airflow into the talk rooms and make it like more of an optional thing, but still have like a good, you know, like not a. Not a crowded telephone booth with five people all breathing in each other's mouths kind of situation.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, in these times, if you're all sat in a tight auditorium and there's, you know, 100 of you in a small room, you've it doesn't seem too much of an ask to just put a mask on.
Yeah, yeah. I get it's harder for the hallway. Like, so that's like one of the other things. Like, I know I've seen other conferences that were like, oh, you mask in the talk rooms and then the hallway, which is huge and spacious. Although I don't know how huge and spacious our hallways will be this year. So if they are great, then maybe we'll do that next year. So
switching gears slightly, I did want to ask about, so the PSF has gotten involved in some legal things, specifically the EU Cyber Resilience Act. I wonder if you could speak to that and why is the PSF getting involved?
Yeah, I would say more legislative than legal. That makes it sound like we're it was just like, I mean, understandably, European legislators were looking at this situation where there's this giant loophole where if you sell somebody software, you're just like, oh, if it gets hacked next week because we didn't do due diligence, like, sucks to be you. And it's like, oh, that's like not a nice feeling for European consumers. And so legislators were interested in doing something about that. I get it. But then they also didn't quite have a grasp on how open source happens and how that gets developed. And so they were like, anyone giving the software out like should be on the hook for making sure that it's liable for any product it shows up in. And it was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. So that's why I wrote on our website. I was like, you know, so we provide all the code on our site, like both the CPython side and the packaging index side, free for anyone to use for any purpose, whatever. Nobody tells us when they're downloading it. We don't create a contractual relationship. We just have like a little license on it. It's like, good luck. Please don't bother us about it if you put it in something dumb. And, you know, it's like, okay, cool. So you would now change this so we would be on the hook for any product any of that code shows up in. And they're like, well, aren't you, you know, I think European legislators saw some of the business models in open source and were like, I mean, you're providing that code because like you're going to sell support for it, right? Or like you're selling the hardware and then like the code is free. So you want a free pass on the code that's absolutely part of your product. And we're like, we actually don't have a product here at all. Like, and so I wrote, like, you know, are people making money with Python? Absolutely. Is the PSF making money selling Python? Absolutely not. So we are completely the wrong place for this sort of, you know, like, for the liability to sit. So that was why I wrote, just like, I think, Some of the larger players in open source that do have a product were pretty well represented because they have, you know, like 16 lawyers on staff or whatever and someone who can pay attention to policy. But the community-driven projects like Python were not at the table and we weren't really being heard by the by European legislators because they were like, I've seen this a bunch of times, like in open source, where like you tell someone like, oh, we're making a lot of code, which is a very valuable thing. And then we are giving it away to anyone at all for free. And they're like, OK, and then what? And I'm like, no, that's the whole thing.
That's it. Like,
OK, wait. But like, there's got to be, you're going to be coming back on the side. And I'm like, no, it's a nonprofit organization that just does this. And they're like, okay, is there like a company next to it? No, there's not a company next to it. So it is a little, it took some education and talking with a lot of different legislators about like, yeah, some of those business models you've seen are happening, some of them, but not all open source is getting created there. And in fact, a lot of the things that are offered for free are sitting in like enterprise level stuff, are running like all kinds of applications that you've heard of, are critically important to the like ecosystem and the way that we, we all understand computing. So there was, it took some education.
Did you get a result? Is there a
yeah. So what happened with the legislation is that they created another type of entity. So they have like a commercial entity, there's consumers, and then they created a third new kind of entity called an open source steward. So an open source steward, and it's really about the activity of providing code for free without a contractual obligation or a financial transaction. So if you're doing that, you're an open source steward. And that's absolutely what Python and PyPI are doing. And that does not incur product liability.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So now that said, like, everyone else who's using Python is now on the hook for like a certain amount of security and liability. So I think the community as whole is going to want to see more like software bill of materials, like reproducibility, you know, that
then,
kind of thing.
But then
in
they
software they
can contribute back to the security developer
in
residence who needs
to
build a...
I think we will have to take on some facilitation because we can't like take in 19 different ideas about like how to do security in the package index. So we may try to synthesize folks' requests and ideas into like a single strategy and vision.
Sure. I mean, Django has a security team and we have a security process. And I think next week there'll be a security release and we've got, you know, we do a good job. But it's all volunteer-based. And it would be lovely if some of the companies that are building products around Django felt, you know what, we're actually liable for this. And it would be nice to just contribute back so that we could say that our liability was covered. That would be a wonderful state of affairs.
We hired Seth Larson to do security here. And he's been great, like, writing about, like, his work. And he has us registered as a CNA now. And so, like, we can receive vulnerability reports better. And, you know, and he's just been modeling what he's doing and writing about it every week so that it's, like, any other project could choose any of those strategies and paths that he's taken to.
Yeah. What's a CNA?
It is a, what is it? A something or other numbering authority. I forgot the C.
Yeah, is it recursive?
Yeah,
is it CVE, like, numbering authority?
Yeah, so it's got an acronym inside the acronym. Yeah, but basically it's like you register and then anyone who's like, oh, I found a vulnerability, like it comes back into you, but you're registered so that it's not, you don't have to like know a person over here to do it.
So when Django does a security release, the blog post will be CVE 2024-19258, and then it will say denial of service on something or other, and that number is goes into a database of all exploits that are known, and you know you can search that, and it's registered, and patches can be attached. This is reference that CVE. So you can look
but
up.
But fellows don't have a CNA, or does someone at Django have a CNA?
Okay, so this was a question: is there a benefit to Django setting up as a CNA? And maybe the thing is, we sometimes have people will try and report an issue, and people are very good. They go through Django, but Curl, for instance, has people registering CVEs against Curl that are just bogus, totally bogus, and then the Curl maintainers need to handle that. So the question is, if Django were to become its own one, we would be able to say no, because we would be the only people who would be able to issue CVEs for Django. And no one, when we can dispute them if that were to happen, but how much of a pain is that? What I'd really kind of like, but I haven't spoken to Seth about it, was if we could perhaps come under the auspices of the Python authority, CNA there, because there's a bit of bureaucracy there, which Django perhaps doesn't have the capacity for, but it would be a known and a trusted thing. And I don't know if that's on Python's roadmap at all, but it's something that has crossed our mind is, well, you know, now Python has that authority, maybe we could be under that umbrella, because it would save us, it would give us a little bit more confidence in some of the worst cases.
I would encourage whoever you think would be kind of responsible for implementing that over at Django to reach out to Seth and talk with him about it.
Okay. I mean, yeah, we should do that. But that was that's literally just a half idea in the back of my head.
Yeah, no. But it's like, that was the point of documenting everything that he's doing, is so that other projects could be like, hi, I wonder what's the deal with that? And it's like, oh, you could actually just like see how it worked out for us. And instead of doing all that research, or try it yourself and find out like, wow, that was a lot of work and not so great for us. Like, I don't think that'll be the outcome, but yeah.
Yeah, to register a like an actual CV, it's not too hard. You have to, the hardest bit is finding the right web form to do it, because there's a website and there's all sorts of links and it's quite hard to find. But once you've found it, it's not too hard to actually. And Python would, you know, Python did offer that to other things. They'd have the same form. But you'd have a back channel to a human being you know to talk to. Yeah. That would be the only real.
Well, but then someone has to be on the other end to respond when the things come in. So you're basically putting out this big, like, security suggestion box. And if nobody's looking in the box, then there's no point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Because it sort of implies that you'll be looking at the reports.
Yeah, no, exactly. So it's, yeah, anyway, that's just me mind dumping.
So we mentioned PyPI and security. There's been, I know E and their team have done a lot about two-factor auth, which from my end went incredibly well, but I know that was hard to see that there was some negative pushback from people maybe who weren't really understanding what was why the reasons for that.
Yeah. So Ian Dustin worked on the first, like, you know, initial, like, kind of test rollout with just the top 100 projects or so, and then what we realized is people just needed a lot more notice and a lot more, like, hey, this is why we're doing this. So so Mike Fiedler, who works on PyPI as our security engineer over there, you know, he probably wrote like a dozen blog posts and things, like getting people ready, like, hey, it's coming. If you have questions, this is why we're doing it. Like, the whole thing, he's been really great about communicating. And I think it went a lot better when we did the wider rollout, just like giving people a lot more notice, a lot more time, a lot more like why we're doing it. Which makes sense. It's community, like, you know, and the other thing that we've found out, like, as Mike has been here, is that, like, there are a few people that have a package on PyPI that maybe forgot they had something over there, like, which is fine. Like, it's been around for a long, long time. And so, and people move on. It's like you put some, like, you gave your thing to the world and then you moved on. Okay, fine. But that's another kind of piece of Mike's work, is looking at, like, what is on the package index, because there's definitely some stuff that's deprecated and that, like, you know, like, it'd be fun to look at for educational purposes, but maybe don't put into, like, a working live modern project or whatever. But stuff isn't really labeled that way over there right now. But that's like kind of on the roadmap, is to make the package index a little bit more like verbose as far as like what it tells people they're downloading and like warns people off of deprecated stuff.
I mean, but the traffic, I mean, your team has published blog posts on it. The traffic is insane, and still, I think, still just kind of up and to the right.
Yeah. Same with Python gets downloaded like 300 million times a day. A bunch of those are probably automated, I hope. Good Lord. So when I say like infrastructure, and you mentioned Ian, they do amazing work. He is amazing. But the infrastructure, yeah, it has been like a hockey stick. And, It's a huge thing. Even with like a massive, well-meaning, polite users, there's still like just the like little questions and things that flicker down. It's like still a lot. You know, and then we also have like a lot of corporate users that are like, oh, this is my work, and it needs to be like everyone else in my work sphere responds like within 5 minutes on chat, you know, and then the package index is like, we'll get to you. So, you know, we're trying to match that up a little bit better with what people want.
So PyPI Slack Discord channel coming soon. Is that what you're saying?
I did not promise that. But we are looking to be more responsive. We understand that people are, you know, like, it is part of their work. And that was part of what E rolled out the organizations, which is still coming. It turned out the legal, accounting, and technical, like, tying those up in a knot was a little bit more to untie. But that's where some of our corporate users would be able to have a little bit more control over their area. Because when we built PyPI, it was just sort of like, everyone is the same. Like, we don't care if you're a team of 80 people at some mega company or like one person that's going to drive by PyPI for 2 hours on a bunch of Red Bull once in like, you know, 2002 and never return. You're all equal to us. And it's, so that's how the infrastructure is, but doesn't quite meet the needs of the community today.
Fine. Good. Good.
So one thing I wanted to ask you actually is, so we talked about open source as if kind of it's one phrase for many things. I've often thought of open source as three buckets where you have nonprofits, which is rare. So like Django is now a nonprofit, Python is. You have corporate sponsored. Sponsorship is a loaded term, but like, so let's say React or Angular. And then you have more solo developer projects. So like Laravel or Vue.js, where there's kind of one person in charge who generally also gets their funding through that way. Does that track, or am I like, how do you think about open source, right? Because we toss it around, but it encompasses so many different things. And really, I think so many different business models is really what it comes down to.
Yeah, I do think there's something different about community-driven open source that's housed at a nonprofit like Django or Python than corporate-controlled open source where like all of the main contributors work at the same company. It's just a little bit different. If everyone works at the same company, they sort of have the same goal and idea about like the direction of the software. And so is that maybe more targeted? Like, yeah, sure. But does that make it like less of like a Swiss Army knife, which is kind of how Python operates? Yeah, that too. So like making it so that the community can kind of build their own extensions and add their own functionality means that, you know, Python has become the glue language we hear sometimes. It's also, like I said, it's a great language for people who don't consider themselves programmers, like biologists and people working on the space program. And they're like, oh, like I use Python every day, but I'm not a Python programmer. And it's like, oh, okay. Well, I'm glad it's easy enough to help you get us to space and help you cure cancer, because those are really important as well. And you can just call yourself whatever you want. That's great work. So yeah, like, but could you do that? Could like all these academics and scientists use a project that lived inside of a corporate silo? Unless that corporation decided that scientists were their customer base, their main customer base, probably not. So, you know, and then it's like the other thing with work where people's work is always evolving, or, you know, maybe there's just one person doing like some kind of new thing, like some sort of digital humanities, like specializing on letters from kings in the 1600s. And it's like, do you think there are enough people for a large mega corporation to write some scripts for those people? I don't. I probably both of them are writing their own scripts to parse the materials from those letters, right?
It is wild that, I mean, just the example you just gave, so many fields now, like physics, even literature, right? Like you kind of have to be a side Python developer just to, you know, get through grad school, let alone be a professor, because it's this tool that is used. I mean, I was literally just talking to someone who was saying how he was thinking about getting a PhD in physics, but he was like, I don't really want to be a programmer. I want to be a physicist. And like, you can't really do that.
Or yeah.
Maybe if you're a theoretical physicist, but even then, you know, they're using AI to help out.
No, they're also using, the time frame where you could just be a guy that drops stuff off of the Leaning Tower of Pisa and called yourself a physicist is probably past.
Yeah. Well, and one thing about the corporate open source, because I think I was certainly victim of thinking, oh, it would, you know, grass is greener, right? Especially in the nonprofit world. Like, it'd be great if there was some corporate overlord who just like paid for everything. But I've heard publicly, like the React team has said, you know, they had to fight Facebook Meta just to open source it. Like, often it's not some like thing where, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's like, yeah, let's open source things. It's like, you know, because that'll help with recruiting, which I would think it would. It's like, no, it's like the team has to really fight to do it in the first place. And then continually, you know, the needs of the for-profit company come first. So many of these corporate sponsored projects are, you know, kind of in spite of their corporate overlords, actually, which makes me feel humanize the engineers behind it, right? Instead of being like, oh, it'd be nice to get paid Facebook money and do open source. It's like, no, they're, they're, you know, really trying and fighting to keep it open source when these big companies, you know, don't really want that, or they don't see that they're not going to prioritize it, I guess is the thing to say.
Yeah. And you're always like, I mean, that's the thing is that like a corporation like is obligated to make money for its shareholders. And so you can, as long as they align, make right. the world a better place, empower people, teach people, have a nice event, like all these different things, as long as they also serve that goal of making money for your shareholders. The minute those two unravel, all of the other things go out the window. It's going to be making money for shareholders. And that's not like, like you said, it's not anything about like the people working inside those companies or that are participating in those systems. It's how that system is set up. Like if you were going to create a new thing from scratch now and you were like, oh, what I don't want is for us to have to do like ethically gross things or whatever, then setting it up as a for-profit company is going to be, you're eventually going to have to pay that bill. So if you want to build software to make the world a better place and empower people, and that's your focus, then you either need to be doing it as a 501c3 charitable organization. You might consider like doing a cooperative where all of you have signed like a contract saying that you're going to like keep community needs first and not take certain kinds of clients that you find ethically objectionable. Or you could set up a B corporation. So there's a couple of companies like that in the US too, which is like a social benefit corporation. So you are allowed to sort of split the difference between your ethical goals and your financial goals without always raising the financial goal to the detriment of any ethical goals that you have added.
One last question for me, and then I know we're coming up on time, which is around, we talked a lot about communication, like, you know, what the board does, and despite blog posts and all these things, people still don't find out. How is the PSF thinking of communication? And I'll give you, on the Django side, like we, for example, don't have an email list of users. Like we don't track anything. So, you know, yeah, there's the people on the board, there's people at conferences, there's a couple hundred people on the forum. But, you know, we struggle with reaching the millions of people using it. And so I'm curious if the PSF has found a solution to that.
I don't know if I would say we would have found the one single solution. There are like so many people using Python. I don't know how we would ever get a hold of all of them. But we have a couple of different channels. So like for people that are interested in kind of like how the PSF is doing, we have a newsletter. For people that just want to stay up to date on PyCon, there's a mailing list for that, and you can stay up to date on PyCon. There is a forum for like general users. There's one in English and there's one in Spanish, where people can go and ask questions or talk about like things going on in their community, or like announce stuff that they're interested in or thinking about or talking about. There is also like a place where you can go and discuss the technical direction of CPython. And so that is another forum that we have that is separate. So like it's not one conversation. It's at least six, but probably more. And then there's other stuff like I know Reddit has a Python sub. We're not in charge of it. If you go there, you probably will be able to tell. It's definitely like.
Is there a Discord for? Is there?
So there's a Python Discord, and then there's Python and Espanol Discord.
Are those official though, or are those unofficial?
No. Well, they are. We don't run them, but we do talk with the moderators over there because it is sort of a space that we want to make sure is nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we maintain relationships over there. The discuss forum that is the steering council we do run. So that one's
right. Yeah, the steering council
to discuss PEPs and stuff. But with volunteer moderators. So, you know, it's like run, but with volunteers. So.
But lots of channels is the take.
Yeah. And there's, I mean, people are still using IRC. Like, I know, Ned is always answering questions from newbies over on IRC. I'm like, that's amazing. I don't know how newbies are finding IRC, but that's great. Like,
before entropy takes over entirely, the final sort of information in the universe will be an IRC message. Just
it's a little bit like, you know, with email addresses, you could tell if someone had like an AOL or a Hotmail or a Gmail, you could kind of guess their the decade they were born in. And I feel like preferred communication channel. I mean, I think about this because I'm like, I like email. Like, I don't want, you know, I don't want to be on Slack or Discord if I don't have to. But, you know, young people are, and they're used to it in work. And we've had some on the show talk about who are doing work to help Django in that area, because they say, yeah, it feels impersonal to people who are just used to communicating that way. And I totally get it. And also, I'm getting old, so, you know, it's good to
have. You just have to talk to people where they are, though. I mean,
yeah.
It's, I don't know. We've shifted a bunch of different time. Like when I started at the Free Software Foundation, it was like Freenode IRC. You know, and what were we using? I think Pigeon or Jabber or something, like inter-office. And then it just keeps changing. And we use Slack at the PSF, which is like, oh, everyone's like, oh, it's just IRC with more like emojis and like a GUI. I'm like, yeah, it kind of is. Okay.
And it's expensive.
No comment.
I mean, because that's a thing, you know, a separate thing on, you know, newsletters, right? With Substack, there's been talk, but like it's wild.
We're still on MailChimp for ours, so.
Which is Intuit now. Yeah.
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 Carlton.
Oh, that's a big black hole. We can't go further down there. Come on.
Yeah.
So, Deb, is there anything else that we haven't asked you about that you saw?
We can ask you, like, so we always ask Django guests, like, what would they, you know, magic wand change about Django? So I guess to you, magic wand for Python, are there some things you're like, ooh, if I could just change them, I would? And that can be code, community, legislative, whatever.
I don't know. It's like, because Python's like different things for different people. And so, and we largely sort of like leave each other alone. So like, even if there was something where I'm like, oh, I don't know if we need that, like someone needs it. So like, I don't think I would change it.
Well, what about the you know, where do you see the PSF in 5 years, right?
Oh, okay. So where I see the PSF in 5 years, I want us to really kind of fully embrace the mantle of being like everybody's beginner language, and do more to support that. You know, like if you haven't downloaded Python yet, I don't want it to be because you didn't know. Like, we're going to come find you and like, you know, make sure that, you know, you could have access to a programming language. But that means like scaffolding a little bit more of like the way that we handle newcomers. I mean, we do a really good job with newcomers who like come to us, but I want it to be a little bit more self-serve, so that if you came to our website and were like, huh, maybe I want to start using this Python thing, and you could get pretty far on your own, like maybe on our website. That's kind of what I'm picturing. Maybe we're teaching Python in elementary school. Like, I don't know. I want it to just be available to everybody. And if you aren't using Python, it's not because you didn't know. It's because you are now using like six other programming languages, after being introduced to programming via Python.
That's a great goal.
Yeah. I think one thing I don't think it's solved yet is that during COVID, all the kids in my school got Chromebooks. And Chromebooks, it's possible, but still difficult to play with Python on the computer itself. You can do it through the web, but you had to kind of go through a Linux thing. And I imagine there's work being done there, but, you know, I think I'm often thinking, oh, everyone has a MacBook Pro, when, you know, like a lot of people are on Windows or Linux or these Chromebooks. And certainly for elementary school kids, something that, you know, so Docker is going to be a problem for kids to dive into in fourth grade. Right. But maybe Python would be a little bit easier once there's smooth Chromebook integration, or, you know, and things like that.
I'll let you know when we start on our Chromebook integration, and remember that you offered to help.
Yeah. Don't bother Google. They got enough going on. I'm happy to do it for free. Yeah.
Well, yeah, we'll just make you the fellow of that.
Yeah. So if anyone, what can people do who are listening who say, I want to get involved in the PSF more than I am? Is there any action items?
Well, we'll have board meeting or board elections coming up in June. You should come hang out with us in Pittsburgh at PyCon this year, which is in May. And tickets are on sale now. And if you don't want to do either of those things, then go find your local Python meetup and get involved over there.
Well, Deb, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time. It's every time
really good.
I talk with you, I'm like, yes, like there is a, you know, happy place that Django and open source can be. And, you know, I think it involves having some paid people who know what they're doing, but, Yeah.
Don't make accountants file. I mean, don't make volunteers be accountants.
Well, I think every organization feels like they're the only ones dealing with this. And it's like, no, like these things are pretty similar across nonprofits and especially tech nonprofits and especially open source nonprofits. So there's behind the scenes, you and the PSF over the years have been very, very helpful to the DSF. So thank you for that.
Yeah. And we'll continue to be pals.
Yeah.
Let me know when you want to hire an executive director. I'll share your postings.
Well, you know, the thing is, I'm not, you know, we were relevant when we started this podcast, but Carlton's no longer a fellow and I'm no longer on the board. So we can just, you know, yell from the cheap sheets.
Yeah. We just throw tomatoes from the back now.
Hey, somebody should do something. But yeah, I do think there's some things happening there. And thank you for the offer. I hope you'll be able to be taken up by it. So thank you everyone for listening. We are at djangochat.com. We'll have links to everything in the show notes and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.